This is The Stateless Man for the pursuit of individual liberty beyond arbitrary borders, oppressive governments, and myths of national obligations. If you value liberty and are willing to migrate and vote with your feet, you've come to the right place.
Welcome to The Stateless Man. This is Fergus Hodgson broadcasting live from the Fort Lauderdale, Florida area, actually in Pembroke Pines. It's my pleasure to be with you, pursuing liberty beyond borders. And we are, pursuing international living, financial independence, and personal sovereignty. Thanks so much for tuning in. We have an interview that I had to get right to. It's a recorded interview with Rodney Hyde, an openly anarchist government minister. And we have limited time before the break to squeeze it in, so I want to go straight to that. I'll pick you up after the break. Thanks.
Thanks for having me on your great show.
It's our pleasure. Now, just for a little bit of background, I know you were an international man and you studied in Montana a few years ago, so your experiences are much more, you could say, prescient or relevant to this audience. What motivated you originally to go back to New Zealand and then, after a few years back, enter into politics?
Well, I was always interested, I think we all are in a way, about trying to make the world a better place. So right from a young age, you're sort of, interested in doing your little bit. And I got very interested in science at high school.
Right.
And back in those days, the environmental movement was just taking off. And, of course, I read all the books, probably age 15 or 16, and got sucked into believing that we were running out of resources or poisoning ourselves or, causing ecological collapse. And so I went off to university to study science and to save the world.
Right.
And along the way, I became very disillusioned with science. I was basically a socialist. I don't think genetically I'm predisposed that way, but in New Zealand, we have a socialist-run education system, and so the curriculum reflects that.
Sure. I'll just note as a little bit of context that in New Zealand, there are no private universities, so it basically is all socialist or a collectivist policy.
Sure, and the primary schools and the high schools sort of reflect the same sort of socialistic ideology. And so I just thought that was, we needed planning and welfare was the greatest invention of mankind. But I don't think I ever instinctively was there. And so when I got into studying science, I became, within a few years, very disillusioned. And the reason being was that the science was all run by the government. Basically, government funded all science in New Zealand.
Mm.
And it was very political, and I just didn't like the politics of it. I would have still called myself, looking back on it, my outlook was very socialistic, but I just didn't like the idea of working for a government department. So I left and went overseas for a few years, working in different jobs, and then I came back to New Zealand, and then I studied again environmental science and did a master's, and that got me interested in economics and also the philosophy of science. And then I came across the works of Karl Popper, of Friedrich Hayek, of von Mises, and these men had a profound effect on me. And so at the same time within New Zealand, this is in the mid-1980s, we were having our own Thatcherite or Reagan revolution.
Sure.
So we were moving from a heavily regulated economy to a deregulated one. And that was a very challenging time for people who are interested in public policy.
Yeah, just if you want to back up there a little bit, when did you go and study in Montana? And when did you encounter...
That was later.
Yeah, when did you encounter the writings of Hayek and the like?
1980s.
Okay.
So I came across, first of all, my interest was actually the philosophy of science. And we were building, it's quite apposite really, given the whole harumph about global warming. We were developing models for the optimal depletion of coal in New Zealand. And so we had, back in the day, these fancy computer models, and I was interested in how you would determine whether a model was any good or not, because it seemed to me that we could make an infinite number of models, and they could fit any amount of data but what told you that a model was any good? And people were very in awe of computers. And that got me into the philosophy of science, and that led me to read Karl Popper's Logic of Scientific Discovery, and I was so enamored of the book that I then read his Open Society and Its Enemies. And that had a big impact on me, and of course I read everything that Popper had written, and that led me to his colleague and friend F.A. Hayek. And, you know, from then I was a Dunberger, really, because I felt like I was coming home. And that's what I mean. I'm an instinctual individualist and a person that rates personal responsibility very highly, and I'm always skeptical of crowds and of groupthink and of committees. And then I taught at university. I taught environmental science, and then I went to Montana, and I did a master's at Montana State University, which was fabulous. I met a lot of free market people there who looked after me. Terry Anderson, Rick Stroop.
Right. Actually, we have a mutual friend there. Rick Stroop and I worked alongside each other at the American Institute for Economic Research, and he's now based in North Carolina, but I know he spent many years, you could say, in environmental economics based up in in Montana.
So I was very lucky, and then I came back to New Zealand, and I basically had lost interest in teaching economics. I went and worked in corporate in a merchant bank for a while. And then we had the swap in New Zealand from a first-past-the-post electoral system to a mixed-member proportional system, which I opposed. Huh. And I got so angry that we ended up with MMP that I got involved to teach the lefties a lesson.
Sure.
Because I thought, well, if the left think that they can make this proportional system work for them, why can't those of us who favour freedom make it work for us? And that's hence the establishment of the ACT Party.
Right.
And I was the sort of founding president of that. And I had never intended, I never used to vote.
Sure.
just because I didn't want to encourage politicians. I had never been on a committee in my life. They put me on one when I was absent at the university, and I made such a hash of it that they never put me on another committee ever again. And so I had no intention of going into politics. I, funnily enough, I couldn't think of anything worse.
You were involved with starting the party. You wanted to
be... Yes.
Okay.
And then the pressure basically... Well, not the pressure, but, you know, the thing came on that, well, hang on, we've got to get this party going. And I thought, well, maybe I'll give it a go and I'll put my hand up. And then you get excited because, you know, naturally you're competitive, and so if you're in the game, you want to win.
Sure.
And so I stood, and I got elected to Parliament. And funny enough, I loved it. I didn't expect to. I went to Parliament, and I absolutely had a ball. And I felt all the time that I was operating behind enemy lines. You know, and I spent 15 years in Parliament. I became a minister. I was a leader of a party that formed a government. And I had a fabulous time involved in politics and understanding politics. Interestingly, I've noticed with the politicians who were, just about everyone else actually, who was left-wing, they just got more and more depressed every day that they were in politics.
Wow.
And I just became more and more positive. And what was happening, I believe, was they were looking at the world and trying to make government work and, of course, failing miserably.
Hmm.
And every time I looked around and saw another government cock-up, it just reaffirmed my belief in why government sucks, really. And I make the joke, I say that I went in as a libertarian and I came out as an anarchist.
Right.
Because I actually don't even think that limited government is viable.
Yeah.
My ideal was no government.
Right, that's an ongoing divide, particularly here in the United States. There's this, you could say, sometimes heated divide, because the problem is that even if we believe in a limited government, then we start debating with each other about what form that should be. Do we believe in school vouchers, or do we believe in closed borders? And we start fighting each other and get distracted from actually reducing the government often. We're approaching the first break. So I just want to say, we're speaking with Rodney Hyde, former minister and member of parliament in New Zealand with the ACT Party. He's now retired from that position. You don't want to miss any more of this. Stay tuned to The Stateless Man. Welcome back to The Stateless Man. We're pursuing liberty beyond borders. That is international living, financial independence, and personal sovereignty. We're speaking with one of the most outspoken and prominent liberty-minded political commentators and former politicians from New Zealand, a role model in that regard. And his name is Rodney Hyde. Just before the break, I mentioned the fact that within, you could say, people who are liberty-minded or concerned about a freer market, there is this dispute about whether you should have what is, for lack of a better term, minarchism or minarchy, as opposed to anarchism or no government. And just during the break, he mentioned that he has some strong opinions on that. And I know he's been following, you could say, the advocacy realm of the liberty movement for a long time, so he can comment on it. Do you want to continue that observation?
Sure. Look, nothing upsets me more in the libertarian movement than sort of arguments over foundational principles and whether one's an objectivist or a classical liberal or sure. whether one's an anarchist or whether you believe in natural rights or, you know, I love that as a debate and as a discussion. And I think it's, you know, look, we're individualists. And so when I say I'm an anarchist, that's what I am. You know, that's where I've got to in my head. That's where how I'd like to live. That's what I think would be the ideal society. I don't try and persuade another human being of that view any longer, you know? Because I'm not into collectivist action. It's the reason the left are so miserable is they can only succeed if they persuade every, you know, or the majority of human beings to agree with them, or they achieve some sort of insurrection. The great thing about being a freedom lover is actually you can live it every day, even in a very, very unfree world. You can actually, you know, remove your mind from the collective mush that goes in the media and which the politicians dish us.
Right.
And live in a libertarian space in your head. You know, I'd still be a libertarian if they had me locked up in a prison.
If I may interject, I'll just say one thing, and maybe you reaffirm this about that view about not bothering, you could say, evangelizing so much, is that, or just letting go of that, is just it's a peace of mind that you don't feel this ongoing need to be out converting people, much like, you could say, religious evangelists or political evangelists. You can have your views, but you don't feel this need to be controlling or changing other people, because obviously that is almost contrary to anarchism or libertarianism.
Absolutely.
To do so.
Absolutely, and that's actually ultimately the liberating view that I've come to, because, you know, I used to feel the need to convince everyone, and I actually think it's an insecurity that you're trying to prove that you're right and everyone else is wrong. And I've seen this with a lot of libertarians, that, you know, they get into an argument, you know, equivalent to how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, and then start quoting, you know, tracts of work and page this, and they said this, and they said that. So to me, I think the great thing about being a freedom lover, a libertarian, is that actually you don't require collectivist action to run your life or to base your world on it. Now when it comes to politics and when it comes to public policy and when it comes to think tanks and institutes, I've got a very simple rule. Is this policy, is this institute advancing freedom, or are they not? And that was, again, my mission in our parliament. Could I push ever so slightly, ever in a small way, the big elephant, and achieve a wee pimple of freedom? And that, to me, is a worthwhile thing. So where people are wanting to get to in their end state, I find very good to discuss and to debate, because it helps with thinking. But in terms of practical public policy and in terms of achieving what we want to achieve, anything that advances freedom is a good thing to my mind. For example, I would favour, of course, no government involvement in schools at all.
Right.
But I have to say that I'd love to have vouchers in New Zealand. That was my one mission I wanted to achieve, was to have vouchers in the New Zealand school system, because that would be such an advance over what we have now. What we're doing in New Zealand now is we have a wee trial with charter schools, and I consider that a huge plus. You know, it's like a wee chink in the Berlin Wall.
Well, I
don't head for perfection. I just go for things that advance freedom.
Yeah, there's a lot to say about the education in New Zealand, because it is a very strong monopoly. Even the private schools in New Zealand basically adhere to the same curriculums and the same teacher training. So there's very little room for choice in that realm. You say you grew optimistic about, or you reaffirmed your views by engaging in politics, and there was maybe an awkward departure. So do you want to discuss about how you perhaps didn't necessarily leave voluntarily?
Oh, no one does from politics. I mean, it's a great thing, really, because you have to fight like hell to get elected, and then you have to fight every day to sort of stay in Parliament and in your place politically, you know. And such as your mindset is, you don't want to give your opponents the joy of seeing you leave. Mm. And so I think we tend to, in politics, stay on longer than we should. And I had finally achieved, you know, my position of great fame and achievement. I was the leader of the party with five MPs. The government was dependent upon us to govern. And that meant that we could start to achieve our agenda. And my hope had been that I'd make sufficient headway, and then I'd set it up for the second term to introduce school vouchers.
Sure.
And but such as it was within sort of the party and circles, others thought they could do a better job, which was fair enough. And so they announced that they were, in fact, a former friend of mine, he was a former Reserve Bank Governor, Don Brash.
Mm.
He announced that he wanted the leadership, and I knew that, funnily enough, I could beat him.
Huh.
I knew that if I had the fight, I wouldn't be able to succeed at the coming election.
Mm.
That I felt the fact that I was being challenged in such a public way by such a strong contender, that would damage me. And so I realised that, and it was a hard realisation to come to, it was over an Easter weekend, that I really had to stand down for, you know, the sake of the party. And so I stood down. And I was actually a bit worried because I'd been 15 years in Parliament, and I thought, I wonder if I'm like one of those prisoners, you know, that you've been in jail so long that when you get out, you don't quite know what to do with yourself.
Sure.
But again, it's been the best thing ever because I've enjoyed myself immensely. And it's allowed me to read more and also to gather my thoughts a lot about politics and about economics and about society and public policy, informed really by the experience. And quite often in politics, I didn't have the time to think and reflect sufficiently.
Yeah, one particular positive outcome from all of this is that now you have a name in New Zealand, people look to you, and you can speak your mind, people listen, so you have an audience. And I was just very impressed by the way you haven't hidden your views. You've basically just called it as you've seen it, which I'll just tell people, here in the United States, there are many people who go around calling themselves libertarians or anarchists, but in New Zealand, you might be the only person in the country. So
yeah, well, I tell the joke that I know of two anarchists in New Zealand, and I'm not sure about the other one.
Sure.
And, no, well, that's another great thing of the experience of politics, because I think in life, my experience was I was always worried about what other people think, and I was always concerned that they'd think well of me and reasonably of me. And of course, you go into politics, and particularly when you're a leader of a political party, I actually won an electric seat, so I had to worry about constituents. You had to be very, very mindful of, it becomes a professional obsession of what people think of you.
Mm.
And what you say and how that'll impact on whether they will support you, because essentially you can't do your job if you don't get the support from the voters.
Right.
And obviously, when I was asked, I never hid the fact that I was a libertarian, but I never made a big song and dance about it either, because, you know, I knew that would get a journalist asking, oh, well, what about schools? And if you start talking about privatizing the schools in New Zealand, you'd be out on your ear.
Right. Just hold there, folks. We have to take a break from this interview. We'll be right back after the break. This is The Stateless Man, and I'm your host, Fergus Hodgson. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're talking with Rodney Hyde. He is a former minister in the New Zealand government, and he was a leader of the ACT political party, which is, I'll explain more about that party after we finish chatting with him. But once he left Parliament, he basically revealed that he was an anarchist and that he didn't believe in any government. That he said he went in as a libertarian but came out as an anarchist. And that drew my attention, and I wanted to get him on. From that perspective, is getting involved in this political realm a good idea? So I want to finish off that interview, then I'll be right back with you.
And so I had to be a bit careful. And so now that I've left politics, I suddenly look around and think, well, what does it matter? I mean, I'm not looking for support any longer. I don't have to, you know. My interest more is to set my thinking straight, and I write a column more often to set my own thinking straight rather than to set anyone else's straight. And I enjoy the fact that there might be one or two people that read them and think, gosh, you know, that's interesting. Maybe what I'm thinking isn't so absurd after all. And I also enjoy the fact that it enrages the left, because I just like it when they get into a tizzy. So I enjoy nothing more than pointing out what a scam global warming is, because at the moment that's the thing that winds them up the most.
Right. Well, I'll just say that you are getting a lot of traction, and you can tell that by the number of comments. The initial article that introduced your position as a columnist in the New Zealand Herald is 106 comments, which suggests to me that it's got probably about 50,000 hits or views of that particular article. Now, just before we go, I mean, our time is limited, but do you have any thoughts on young people getting into the political realm? I often say that just focus on your own life if you want to live a certain way. Don't expect politics to change. As you mentioned, there's only incremental changes can come about. Would you have any thoughts for people who are considering it?
Oh, yes. By all means, do it. Look, I didn't admire politicians or politics, and for a long time I felt quite seedy as a politician because of my political outlook. And I got through that, and politics was a wonderful, wonderful experience because I got to meet so many people. I don't know whether I made a difference or not, but I developed my thinking enormously. And the great thing is now is I get into an argument with a lefty, and they can never say to me, oh, you don't know how it works. You know, you don't understand politics. I had a great debate on the radio here in New Zealand with a young Green Party member who's trying to get elected to Parliament.
Okay.
And he was astonished that I don't vote. And it was the most appalling thing that he'd ever heard, you see, that someone didn't vote. And, of course, I enjoyed it immensely because I was explaining to him how politics didn't matter that much and that in New Zealand we place far too much emphasis upon politics when what is actually happening is in the family and communities and businesses, and yet we focus on what politicians are thinking and doing. And I could do that and say that with some, if you like, legitimacy because I had been a senior politician in New Zealand. If I had been an outsider hissing rocks, I would have just sounded like a disgruntled, failed politician.
Right, and you don't have to comment on this, Rodney, but I do know that right now the ACT Party in New Zealand is under serious pressure, and they're going to be looking to find a new leader. Are you willing to say whether you're interested in getting back into the ring?
No, I'm not interested, and I've explained to everyone that, you know, I never say never. But
sure.
I'm not at all interested. I don't think it would be good for the party or good for me or good for politics. And the reason for that is like anything that you do, you want to do it to the best, and that requires a huge passion and a huge commitment. And I know that if I went back a second time around, I wouldn't have that level of passion and commitment.
Sure.
And so I'm busy in the background helping others to make their mind up and put their name forward because, again, politics is a funny business. It's like, you know, fashion. It comes and goes. And so I had a great moment in the sun. I had a great time in politics. I, you know, got into government. I got to make some big decisions and push the boat out a bit. And then it passes, and then it's time for the next generation to step up. And I always encourage anyone that favours the market and free enterprise, if they're interested, to get involved in politics. I don't think you have an obligation to, but if you're interested, you should, because the more people that we can get in any political party, the better off we'll be as a society. I'd like to have more freedom-loving people in Parliament.
Right. Well, Rodney, I want to say I really appreciate your views. Right. We had to finish it up there. Rodney Gay was very generous with his time, and I've got until the next break to give some reflections on his thoughts. And I was just thinking, too, that as I was listening to that interview, which we did about a week ago, I was just thinking that there's a lot of context that I perhaps need to convey to people, because I grew up in New Zealand and I left to go to college in the United States when I was 19, and then I went back for a few years. So obviously it's very familiar to me. I grew up when Rodney was prominent, and I got to meet him back in 2008
when there was an ACT Party campaign gathering in Matamata, this town about, I'm thinking, an hour or so out of Hamilton in a rural part of New Zealand. And at that time, I was very interested in getting involved, but I decided I just needed to be on firmer footing financially, and I left New Zealand to look for better prospects abroad. So if you want to call in, though, if you've got comments on what Rodney had to say, you're always welcome to do so at 1-800-313-9443. But let me just give you a bit of context, because he mentioned MMP, for example, and this is an important underlying element that allowed him to get into Parliament. In New Zealand, back in the 1990s, when I was a child, we still had a similar system to what the United States has in terms of actual elections. We had, it's called first past the post, where there are districts, and the person who gets the most votes in each district, whether it's a majority, minority, whatever, that person goes into Parliament. There was a lot of concern that that did not fairly or accurately represent a diverse population or the constituency, that some people who happen to have the, you know, dominant view, let's say there's an issue where there are 60% of people who think a certain way, they might end up with having basically all the members of Parliament because that median voter had tremendous power. And so the thinking was to switch to a different electoral system, and there was a referendum on the matter, which included a range of options. One of them was just to stay the same, first past the post. And in fact, I think my parents were proponents of that. And I was this child. It was back, I would have been only 11 or 12 years old. And I was thinking, what? We need a change. I was debating with my parents even back then. New Zealand went to, of the range of options, people chose MMP. And that's mixed member proportional representation, which means you actually get two votes, and it can get kind of complicated. Even people in New Zealand who do vote may not understand it. There are holes open for gaming of that system, although I don't know that anyone really has. There are further complications in this process where in New Zealand there are actually seats set aside for ethnic people, the quote, Māori seats. That's a very problematic element, but it doesn't necessarily relate to Rodney's rise. What Rodney referred to was that once MMP came in, there was much greater room for minority parties to get into Parliament. It meant that, you get two votes. You get one vote for your electorate or your area, and then one vote for a party. And so long as a party won 5% of the votes or a single electorate, in terms of a person in an electorate, that party would have access to Parliament. And then, of all the parties who won entrance into Parliament, they would get their party vote percentage into the House. And so I think in its best position, ACT got around 8%. So they got, out of 120 people, they got maybe about 10 or so members. Regardless, they did get some influence in New Zealand, even though they were an openly pro-market party. And it also opened the doors to other people getting in. But we are approaching the break. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm going to explain a little bit more about the situation in New Zealand, because it is obviously very close to me, and there's plenty to say about it. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to The Stateless Man, Pursuing Liberty Beyond Borders. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're discussing the experiences of Rodney Hyde in elected office in New Zealand, and I had the privilege of interviewing him, about a half an hour interview, and we discussed all matters of things, particularly, you know, the viability or value of actually engaging in the political realm. And Rodney had came out after being in office or resigning from his position as an anarchist, that he believed that no government would be necessary or better than what we have, and also that he thought the people in New Zealand devoted too much time or resources to the political realm, and that distracted from family life, from business interests, from things which are much more productive or valuable. But at the same time, he said, if you have a personal interest, if you would enjoy doing so, go ahead. If you're a liberty-oriented person, join up and have the experience. And he spent 15 years in office, and he said it was a fascinating period of his life. He feels much better going out, and he thought he would be too accustomed, but in fact it's the opposite. He's really enjoying life outside of the political realm, and he does not plan to go back. I guess that's the news element of the interview, that right now in New Zealand, there's a lot of scrutiny going on with that political party that he's been part of, ACT, or the Association of Consumers and Taxpayers, which began really back in the mid-1990s, to be given the opportunity for minority parties to enter parliament in New Zealand. So there's a lot of scrutiny because the current leader is basically, as far as I can tell, going to be stepping down because of corruption charges, which seem to be on the mark, that he actually did engage in some fraudulent behavior. And there is a new potential candidate seemingly leading the pack. I'm not so up to date in terms of how many people are vying for this, but there's a man named Jamie White, and I've been in touch with him. We're going to be getting him on the show as well, because New Zealand presents one of the most liberty-oriented countries on the planet. Now, that shocks me to say. I feel almost uncomfortable saying it because I know New Zealand and it does not seem very liberty-oriented. It just indicates to me how so often and perhaps everywhere we have our backs against the wall as people who are conscious of liberty, of various aspects, be it gun ownership to freedom of speech, freedom of religion, whatever it may be. Freedom of movement. So New Zealand is up there. According to the Fraser Institute and the Heritage Foundation and the Wall Street Journal, New Zealand is basically the freest, you could say, conventional state or conventional nation. The only two that really edge it out are Hong Kong and Singapore, which are really city states or island nations, which are peculiar in their situation. So the ideal of liberty in New Zealand is so important because, as almost everywhere seems to be going negatively, at least in the developed world, New Zealand is one place that I don't want to see crumble. And so, yeah, Jamie White, he is the potential replacement for Rodney Hyde, and he's been a philosophy professor at Cambridge University, and he's written a whole bunch of books on basically how politicians manipulate you. And I'm really glad that I may be able to get him on the show. Like I said, I have been in touch with him, and I've got my assistant pursuing him. If you have other people you want to recommend, you can always email me, Ferg, that's F-E-R-G, at the Stateless Man. And like I said, Jamie, we're looking to get him on. His books are Crimes Against Logic, Exposing the Bogus Arguments of Politicians, Priests, Journalists, and Other Serial Offenders, Free Thoughts, the Collected Columns of Jamie White, and Bad Thoughts, A Guide to Clear Thinking. And the Free Thoughts one, the Collected Columns, is his latest. And that's not correct. But in 2013, he published two books. The other one was Quack Policy, Abusing Science in the Cause of Paternalism. So he is not so well known in New Zealand, but he's obviously an intellectual heavyweight and someone that you'd want to get to know. I'm eager to hear more from him and to discuss not only why he wants to, what policies or why he's getting involved, but basically why he would let go of a now career in management consulting. He's moved on from being a philosopher to be working in the private sector, why he would let that go in presumably a lucrative manner or fashion to going back and entering the political fray or descending into it, which is very difficult. And one element which may be important to consider as well is that in terms of understanding Rodney's story and you could say the liberty movement in New Zealand is that we discussed this briefly, but New Zealand is not an individualist society at all. That is simply not the case. And the fact that it is more pro-liberty in terms of its policies is actually somewhat of an accident and an artifact of history that is almost the opposite of the case. That is to say that New Zealand was going downhill in terms of its national debt, its unsustainable policies, and therefore had to go through a purging process. So it's almost irresponsibility led to the purge, which was very good. And people often ask me, is there a libertarian party in New Zealand and what is the promise there? And while ACT, the party that Rodney Hyde was involved with, was not openly libertarian, and that's why he noted in the interview that he didn't really wear it on his sleeve, and I didn't even know that he either went by the term libertarian, let alone that he was an anarchist. That was simply not known in public, and he could have been more vocal about it. He was a big celebrity. He was on Dancing with the Stars, kind of a joke, but he became very well known in New Zealand as a celebrity, and he did not release that. And just there's one tidbit that I think is illustrative of the strength of the Libertarian Party or Libertarian movement in New Zealand. Because firstly, like I said, I want to say that ACT, the party that Rodney was a part of, is not openly libertarian and has many, you could say, non-libertarian aspect, such as being, quote, tough on crime, when the crimes are things like drug use or whatever it may be. I mean, they're playing the political game, I guess, and that maybe they're succeeding sometimes, sometimes not. And the leader of the party, John Banks, right now, is hardly a libertarian man. I mean, I don't really want to say much about him, but I would never consider him in that mold. There is, on the other hand, an actual libertarian party called the Libertarians, with the Z on the end, and they have been around a while, I think since the mid-90s as well, and I used to get their email updates and follow what they were doing. And I will admit, I have voted in my life. When I was back in New Zealand in 2007, I think the election was in 2007, no, maybe 2008 perhaps, I was thinking about who I should vote for, and obviously I wanted to support some sort of Liberty candidate. These days I can't vote, and I don't vote, I don't really worry about it. And I chose to vote for the Libertarians. This is in the Port Waikato district, I think. And there were about, I think, 37,000 or something, between 30 and 40,000 votes in my district out of maybe 80,000 people or something like that. And the Libertarians Party received 17 votes. I'm not sure what that is in terms of percentage. Let's just say it's less than 0.1%. So basically what happened is that there was almost zero. I mean, the 17, one of which was my vote, represented an extremely small minority, and I'm guessing some of those votes were just by accident. So that was the strength of the Liberty support, or vocal support for libertarians. So that is the big challenge right now in New Zealand, that although we have some policies which are pro-liberty and somewhat of a history of being more pro-liberty, it's not necessarily because the people want it. And the political party at play, the Libertarians, the only one that's actually vocal about being pro-liberty and using the rhetoric, which is not ACT, not Rodney's party, they have almost zero support. So that it's a big upward battle. It's not like going to New Hampshire where the motto is live free or die. So we have these parties with almost zero support. This may be changing with Jamie White going back there, the openly libertarian or pro-liberty philosopher, and that's why I'm so eager to follow that. I will, like I said, I'm going to do my best to get him on. Otherwise, we're going to have Guillermo Jimenez up next. He is on the columnist for the Pan Am Post. Don't go anywhere. This is The Stateless Man. Welcome back to The Stateless Man. We're in the second hour of the program. Thank you for tuning in. It's a pleasure this morning. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Rodney Hyde. We are going to switch gears back to the American continent, or North America. And we're going to examine a topic which is of great concern to me, and I think of meant to many people. We have Guillermo Jimenez. He is a multi-talented man. He has his own podcast. He's a columnist with the Pan Am Post, which I think is called the Constitution Free Zone. And he's written an article which I wanted to expand further. It's called The Big Lie, Narco-Terrorist Boogeymen and Our Government Saviors. And you can see that on the Stateless Man Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thestatelessman. Please consider liking the page for all these updates. Below, I place a link to the show on the page, and then below it I place links to the content we're discussing as we proceed. You can also follow the Twitter page, which is just @thestatelessman. So we have Guillermo. He is based in Laredo in Texas, right on the border. So he knows all about what is going on down there. He's a talented man, and he actually used to have a show on RBN as well. But Guillermo, I know it's early. It's only 9 o'clock over there on a Sunday morning. I appreciate you coming on the show, okay?
Absolutely, Fergus. Good to be on. And, yeah, good to be back on RBN. So as you mentioned, I did have a show on here up until 4 months ago or so, Traces of Reality, which hopefully many of you RBN listeners out there are still tuning into as a we transitioned over into a weekly podcast. So, thanks for the intro, man. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I still listen to your podcast. I've got it on my iTunes feed. And you discuss many topics. I mean, you could say broadly speaking, the police state, perhaps, is the theme. And you could say truth in media, because, well, I mean, this is the whole point of RBN on just independent media, is that we believe, and you agree, I guess, that most media is just entertainment and junk. And often I forget that, but because I don't watch TV, right?
Good practice.
Yeah. I mean, I have a TV in my room, but I haven't turned it on yet. I didn't even, like, yeah, anyway, so where I live now. But Sometimes I go to airports, you know, not sometimes, but I go to airports, and that's, I guess, either the airports or the gym, there'll be TVs on. I'll go, is this what people are watching? You know, but, and that's why, I mean, I'm so glad to have you involved with the Pan Am Post, because I think you understand the need for independent media, and you are, you're doing it, you're living in an independent voice. Yeah, so in your, the theme of your column is, you could say this rights-free zone, and one, you could say, it, particularly associated with the border, but you expand upon that, that it's beyond that. Now, we have the full hour. I brought you on early because one of my other guests, I was planning on having someone to discuss Bitcoin for the next half hour, but he could not make it. He just called in a couple of hours ago and said he wouldn't be here. So we've got more time to play with. So we can kind of expand our discussion. But the particular article that is perhaps one of your best so far, it's a great one, is The Big Lie, Narco-Terrorist Boogeymen and Our Government Saviors, and it relates to an interview you did with Anabel Hernandez, the journalist in Mexico. Now, let's get right to it. What is the big lie?
Sure. You know, yeah, it's, as you mentioned, it's based on that interview with Anabel Hernandez. For those of you out there who don't know, she wrote the book called Los Señores del Narco, which is translated into English as Narco Land. Very, very popular book, best-selling book. And basically, the big lie is that this war on drugs is being fought to protect you, you know, the individual citizen, from these narco-terrorist boogeymen and from the threat and from the threats of narcotics, or the threat that the inherent threat supposedly that drugs pose. And that is indeed the big lie, as we've discovered, as Annabelle discovered through her research, and many other researchers, of course, have written about this. But what's particularly interesting about Annabelle's story is that what she wrote was so dangerous to the establishment in Mexico. It so shook the very core of the political establishment that she's now under 24-hour protection, bodyguard protection, still living under the threat to her life and to her family's life. It's really quite remarkable, the courage that this woman has to keep pushing forward with this story. And basically what she discovered is that, you know, it goes all the way to the top as far as Mexico goes. And I would say by extension that would apply to the United States government as well. But the corruption goes all the way to the top. She discovered connections between Mexico's, one of Mexico's top security officers, Genaro Garcia Luna, and that he was working directly with cartels. And this is something that we've all suspected, you know, but she was able to dig up the tangible proof to make those connections. And right. Like I said, that was a very, very dangerous thing for her to do, to expose. She did it anyway, and she's facing the consequences. And again, you know, by extension, I would say that this implicates the United States government in this. If we follow our history, we know that this has been happening for quite a long time. We can at the very least point to what took place in the 1980s during the Iran-Contra scandal. And we can at the very least take that example, a very well-documented example, and say, look, we have a clear case of the United States government working directly with drug cartels in Mexico and in the whole of Latin America, but specifically in Mexico, for political gain, because we were using, for example, the ranch land of one of the top drug lords at the time, Rafael Quintero. Rafael Caro Quintero, we were using his ranch land to train guerrillas, basically these people who went on to create death squads and go into Guatemala. So the story goes a long way.
Yeah, it is very deep. And I think one of the biggest benefits from her work, which is real journalism, right? It's the journalism that you and I really appreciate. One of the biggest benefits is that it removes this veneer of prestige, legitimacy, whatever, that these politicians and their henchmen in fancy suits presume to have.
Right.
And I because I don't know why people don't realize that these people are criminals. And I watched an interview with Michelle Malkin yesterday, actually, and this is from way back, and she was describing a book she's written about the corruption in the White House in the United States. And she just went down this crazy list of how this person was caught shoplifting, this person didn't file her taxes, this person was suspended from her law license. And I was just thinking, what? You would have a hard time trying to find so many criminals in one group. Yeah, you're like, all in the White House. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. No, indeed. And that, again, that, I think that really is the big takeaway from this, from her book, from this article that I've written up based on the interview, is just that, is that the real criminals are in the government. The real cartel leaders, the real gangsters, the banksters are in government and in banking and in big business, and they work together. And it's not that, you know, I have more contempt for those people, the guys at the top, the guys benefiting from this, profiting from it, the guys really, really managing this drug war. I have more contempt for them than I do, you know, your average everyday slinger of dope on the street. You know, at least he's honest about what he does. You know what I mean? Right. So, anyway, I guess we got to go to the break.
Yeah, you're hearing the music. This is Guillermo Jimenez of tracesofreality.com. Don't go anywhere. This is The Stateless Man. This is The Stateless Man. Welcome back. We're pursuing liberty beyond borders. I have with me Guillermo Jimenez of tracesofreality.com and the Traces of Reality, or TOR, radio podcast. He also has Demanufacturing Consent podcast, which you can also find at just tracesofreality.com. We are examining, you could say, the broader topic of the drug war and, you could say, a critical view of that. Guillermo wrote an article about this called The Big Lie, about the boogeyman of the drug war. And we just discussed how there's a journalist, Anabella Hernandez. I've written an article about how she's my hero of journalism, actually, a wonderful lady. How she is, you could say, unraveling the script or the narrative. But I wanted to just touch upon the fact that these drug lords, they are real. Like, in terms of them being boogeymen, they do exist, and they are vicious. I would not want to mess with them.
No, it's a good point. There's a reason why this stuff isn't covered anymore in Mexico. It's not because it's all, you know, fake and all made for TV. No, the danger is very real. The retribution that journalists face for talking about this stuff is very real. The threats are there. I won't deny any of that. You're absolutely right that as I asked this is one of the questions I had for Annabelle, actually, during our interview. You know, I asked her, you know, to what extent she thinks that El Chapo Guzman, for example, is just a frontman, is just a figurehead, a public face. And her answer to that was complicated, but basically it's what you said, that these guys are real. They're vicious. They're killers. They're murderers. Yes, all of that is true. However, these guys would not exist. They would not be in the position that they're in without the government, without people within the state aiding them along the way. One of the things that she wrote in her book that I found most interesting is that El Chapo Guzman, for example, I'll keep using him as an example because he's the most widely known, and he's all on the cover of Forbes magazine and all the rest of that, right? So, but this guy came from the marijuana and poppy fields of Mexico. He was, I mean, dirt poor, illiterate, probably.
Can he read? Can he read now? Yeah.
To this day, he might be illiterate. We don't know, right? But, I mean, he left school when he was like 7.
He delegates his reading to other people.
He doesn't need to read, right? Yes, he has it all read to him. Take a letter. That's what El Chapo would say. but yeah, so this guy, you know, and so you have to wonder, you know, how did someone like this move up in the ranks and reach the levels that he has? And what if she found out is that without what she calls, you know, the businessman, and by that I take to mean, you know, big business and the state, without those two entities behind these drug cartels, people like Chapo Guzman would not exist. They just simply would not be in the position that they're in.
That's a great point. And first, I mean, there's a lot to say about it. She said, not only are they, you could say, vicious or violent men, but they're acting in a very almost public way. that they will go. She meets with people in these beautiful restaurants and like in the big cities, so they could not get away with that if there really was this quote war against them.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
One thing that this happens when you have these drug wars that you could say almost like a mystique follows them, and there are all these legends. But first, I wanted to note that at least if you read the online accounts, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, he has a 30-man, basically little military, traveling around with him at all times.
Yeah.
But one part of the story, which perhaps fits into what you were just referring to, is that he was in prison for, was it 10 years or something like that?
Right, yeah.
A long time.
Yeah.
and
he got busted out, right. And that's a very interesting part of the story. That, you know, the official narrative was for a very long time that the guy escaped in a laundry cart, you know, and that's just silly, I think, on its face. But as it turns out, as she discovered in her research and by interviewing people who worked at the jail, actually what amounts to the warden of the jail, basically, she talked to, who was himself accused of aiding El Chapo in his escape. But she referenced the original reports, the criminal reports, the files, and she discovered that indeed he escaped by just simply, you know, putting on a police uniform and literally just walking out of the prison. And so that, of course, implicates people within government that assisted in his escape from prison.
I guess if you're going to escape from prison, walking out seems like the easy.
Right. Yeah. Nobody died in a laundry cart, just simply, yeah, walk your way out. but that's a really good point, man. None of this makes sense under the current paradigm that most people that still live under regarding the drug war. It doesn't make sense that these guys, as you said earlier, are out and about, walking around like they own the place, in the best restaurants, the best hotels. Not hiding anything. They post to their Facebook pages and their Twitter pages, posing with gold-plated AKs. I mean, these guys are shameless because they're almost untouchable, not just because of the threat of violence that they impose, but because they are protected. They are protected because this is something that I concluded in my article. It's an important thing that I think for people to take away from is that this is a multi-billion dollar industry, right? It's something like the estimates are now like $400 billion international trade that just in drugs, right? And so when you consider the dollar amounts in this, I think it would be naive to think that there wouldn't be powerful people at play. And by powerful, I don't mean these cartels. Of course, I mean the true power elite, right? They have their hands in all these pockets, and there's a lot of money involved in this. And so it follows reason, I think, that the banks have a vested interest in keeping this going. The governments of these countries in Mexico have a vested interest in keeping prohibition and keeping this drug war going. The UN officer, I forget his name, I think it was Costa, wrote that in 2008, you know, when we were on the brink of total economic collapse, the only thing that saved the banks was drug money. That was the only liquid asset in banks was drug money. Without that, they would have completely collapsed. And by extension, again, the governments of these countries in Latin America would have collapsed. So drug money is what keeps things going.
That actually was probably one of the more revealing elements of your article, the way that international banks are involved with this. So if you have financial intermediaries of enormous power and leverage involved, it seems like, let me try to sum that up. But basically, there's a chain of beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. And one of the elements which I guess libertarians talk about all the time, which is necessary, and we need to repeat it, is that it's much more lucrative when it's illegal.
Sure, absolutely.
And so you would not have a billionaire from selling marijuana or cocaine if it were legal, right? Mm-hmm. That just would, like, a market. I mean, how many billionaires are there from selling, I don't know, corn, right? I mean, you know, so
yeah.
it just seems very strange the way that this particular element is not seen. We do have, you know, people who I'm sure are kind of for the drug war here, listening to RBN. If people want to make the case that we really should be worried about these people and going after them, you know, I'm glad to hear from you. Don't hesitate to call in. Number is 1-800-313-9443. So don't go anywhere, folks. This is The Stateless Man. Welcome back to The Stateless Man, pursuing liberty beyond borders. I want to say I appreciate all listeners to the network and to the podcast. If you want to give me feedback, you can do so at ferg@thestatelessman.com. I want to note also, before I forget, that RBN is continuing its pledge drive. RBN will basically give back or reciprocate donations of $100 or more with an RBN mug and t-shirt, or you can choose a 25-ounce copper Republic of Texas coin. You can call the number. The number to donate is 1-800-724-2719 to donate to RBN. We have two callers on the line who want to get in on this discussion of these boogeymen and the drug war, and we have got an expert online, Guillermo, who's here to take their questions and comments. So first, let's go to Tom in Brooklyn. Please go ahead, sir.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm really enjoying this because, you know, the boogeyman... drug dealer situation. I'm going to look at it from a completely different point of view. Okay.
Yes.
Number one, all of these drug related killings and everything these people are enforcing their own. They have a corporation in this this country that employs more people than McDonald's. Okay.
Actually, that's one thing.
I'll give you some talking points, and you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay.
Number two, the drug trade in America creates more millionaires than our Ivy League schools.
Who is giving you this data, sir?
Oh, listen, the Drug Enforcement Agency. Just look at the numbers. Okay? Just look at the numbers. Here's an interesting situation. Now, for people who don't have an education, okay, and there's no jobs, the legalization of drugs is about to happen. The reason why, not only because the government wants a piece of the cut that was formulated on the people that they've already put in jail, but because if they legalize the drugs, especially marijuana, the people become more complacent, and they will not realize that there's no work for them. So there's nothing better to do than sit around and get high. There's no factory for you. When the guys come home from war, where do they go to work? There is no jobs here. The people might catch on. This is exactly the same model of the Soviet Union. Whenever the people got restless, they cheapened the price of vodka. You know?
Interesting, sir. Tom, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to hand this up. Cameron, let me question you.
Sure.
Are there any numbers on how many, you could say, footmen these cartels have in the United States?
There probably are, Fergus. I don't have them, top of my head, or available to me at the moment.
No, but there was some staggering number, something like 100,000 or something. There's a huge number of footmen that the Hawkins footmen.
Yeah.
But regardless, I just want to touch on before you. I mean, I'm kind of interrupting there, but basically,
sure.
He said they want a piece of the pie, and many people don't know this, but actually, at least in North Carolina, and I'm guessing many other states, they already tax these quote unauthorized substances. So
yeah, I see where Tom was going with this. I mean, he has a point on as far as the way alcohol has been used to placate the public with the price of vodka falling. This happened in the United States during slavery. During the holidays, they'd allow slaves to basically indulge in liquor, and that kept them placated for a liminal period, is what they called it. So there's some truth to the way alcohol has been used. I don't see it working with marijuana. It's a very, very different substance. Maybe Tom's not personally familiar with it, which is fine and dandy, but doesn't have quite the same effect in that way. But to the larger point about the government doing this to get a cut from it, listen, black ops require black markets, okay? That's the way it works. This is the way black operations have been funded throughout the United States' history, throughout the CIA's history. The way to keep money off the books and to be able to engage in black ops in South America and the Caucasus, all over the world, really, is to have a steady flow of drug money coming in that you can have access to. Without that, these operations would be very, very difficult to fund. So that's number one. So I think Tom's a little bit confused with that. There's really the government has less to gain through the end of prohibition than to benefit. It's not to their benefit to end prohibition because, and I've said this repeatedly on my program for the people that have, listened, and but I think it bears repeating right now that before there was a war on terror, there was a war on drugs. That has been the biggest threat to our civil liberties for a very, very, very long time. People seem to think that this all started with 9/11. And with good reason, right? It certainly has escalated in the past 12 years, the threats to our civil liberties. But it didn't come from out of nowhere. It didn't change, you know, overnight. This has been a steady threat. And the biggest pretense for limiting civil liberties at the expense or for the sake of security has been the war on drugs. It's the reason your police in your local cities are militarized. That is the reason.
I got you. And also, you probably read the story too about how these moves to decriminalize or legalize marijuana have got police units up in arms. Oh my, we may not get our funding.
Exactly. Exactly right. They will lose a lot of funding.
Let's not have police tanks. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, again, that's the biggest reason. I mean, sure, these days the rhetoric is more, you know, oh, we've got to protect you from terrorists and, you know, Al-Qaeda and, you know, whatever. But before that, and even still, the majority of the time, it's the drug war.
Right. We do have someone else on the. I want to just say too that Tom, I appreciate your concern that, well, you know, people who are high aren't as much of a threat to government. I don't know how much weight there is to that, but we want to go to our next caller, Bill in Idaho. Please go ahead with your question or comment, Bill.
Yes. Good morning. Great broadcast. I just wanted to mention. I'm hoping Deanna and Dr. Lorraine Day are going to cover these issues as well. Dr. Lorraine Day is going to be on the broadcast Monday, Wednesday, and on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this week. And this is such an important issue. There are millions of people that are dying over the control of markets that occur supposedly in a pre-republic. It's absolutely astounding. But even here locally, the core group is the only one that's allowed in a Grand Soviet to ask questions during a election process or, you know, an open debate of issues here locally. And they always refer to the situation as being, you know, are we going to allow marijuana to become a free enterprise market product? And actually, in point of fact, it goes back even to the larger issue of hemp as far as being an industrial element that would be available for our economy, which was where we were when we started the Republic, ultimately, and the jobs that are associated with it. How best to cause a full, free, and open discussion of this issue so that we actually get back, quote-unquote, the right to have whatever industrial or agricultural product that we wish.
Okay, I really appreciate your thoughts there, actually, and I don't know whether people, you know, I do this, but I do. I buy hemp, actually, right, and I use it as a protein supplement. And where does it come from? Canada. Manitoba. So you're right.
Interesting little trivia fact. I'm sure a lot of RBN listeners already know this, but maybe people have forgotten that the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp. So
I don't know if that is true. But I've heard that's a myth. But regardless,
my knowledge, that's true, and I don't doubt it. Considering that as Bill just mentioned, it was a vibrant, you know, very viable product. Continues to be viable, but It was used for many different purposes, as you all know, I'm sure. It's silly. It really is silly that is illegal. I mean, it's silly to me in my mind that it's illegal, but that's just specifically, you know.
It is silly, but, you know, and thanks for your call, Bill. We got to roll to the break. This is the Stateless Man. Welcome back to The Stateless Man. It's my pleasure to be with you. We're speaking with Guillermo Jimenez of Traces of Reality, of the TRR podcast, and of the Demanufacturing Consent podcast. And the drug war is the topic today, and in particular these boogeymen. We've gone through how these boogeymen are so closely aligned with people in government that they're basically catalyzed or protected by government, and that enables enormous profits. Further, these profits flow through international banks, which enjoy the profits from those. Now, one particular element that Guillermo brought up that is of concern to people on this network, and it's a great concern to me, is the way that the drug war preceding the, quote, war on terror, whatever, you know, anyway, that's another problem. But anyway, so preceding the war on terror, it was used as a pretext for the police state. And I want to just give one article to lead into this, which I'm sure you've heard about, Guillermo. The headline is, Texas deputy killed in Dawn no-knock drug raid, right? Mm. I mean, surprise, if you kick someone's door down, you know, in the middle of the night, they're going to shoot you.
So
I'm going, like, this is just dumb. But anyway, so this police officer died, and I feel sorry for him to some degree because he's carrying out these dumb rulings. But this was to be expected. Do you need to expand upon that point that the drug war is basically fueling the police state?
It absolutely is. And as far as the no-knock warrants go, just quickly, I mean, that's happened so many times the other way. So many people have been killed. I mean, in this year alone, I think we're up to about 40. Last year, 2013.
Yeah, 2013.
Yeah, there were 40 people killed, roughly. I need to go back and check the numbers. But 40 people killed in this way. A no-knock warrant, police come through the door, you reach, as anyone who keeps a firearm at home, it's 3 or 4 in the morning, and someone bursts through your door, that's probably what you're going to go for first, is your firearm. Well, they do naturally and get blown away. It's happened over and over and over again. But to your point about the police state, man, I mean, it's absolutely true. A good book on the subject is Radley Falco's book on it, who's done a really good job of chronicling the militarization of police as it relates to the drug war. But, I mean, just broadly speaking, it's clear as day to me, for someone, as you mentioned earlier, who's from Laredo, Texas, on the border, anyone who travels this way, the police state is very, very vivid in the form of these checkpoints, which, as you know, we've talked a lot about. But it most perfectly exemplifies the police state as a result of the drug war are these checkpoints all along within this 100-air-mile radius known as this Constitution Free Zone, where basically you can be stopped, questioned, your things can be searched, you can be searched, your vehicle. The latest court ruling on this just came in a few days ago out of New York. Which further cemented this, and basically the judge affirmed that yes, they can search your smartphone, your laptops, electronics, anything is fair game, not just at the border, but at what they call border equivalents, the airports, these checkpoints, and so forth. So that, in combination with the militarization of police, in combination with so many other things, I think, again, the police state is very much here, it's very much present, and it's very much connected to the so-called war on drugs.
You know, I listen to a lot of talk radio, just as you do, I'm sure, and often I listen to a show which has what can loosely be described as a conservative audience in New Orleans, and people will often call in saying that if we let go of the drug war or fighting it, that basically, you know, we're giving up and people will use more drugs and it'll have, you know, detrimental impact on society. It's hard for me sometimes to, you could say, approach these almost like different spheres of perception that you see this too, that people live, like, we live in the same physical world, but we might as well live in different worlds in terms of perception.
Mm-hmm. And no, I completely. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, what I would say to that person who still thinks that way. I mean, I could take two approaches, but one would be to simply point at the way other societies have managed and have not crumbled as a result of marijuana legalization. We'll see what happens in Uruguay. But for example, in places like, the most common, I suppose, example is Amsterdam, right? So why not use it? There's a really good documentary by Kevin Booth, who I've had on my show previously, who did the documentary American Drug War. And he visits Amsterdam. And to his surprise, no one in Amsterdam that he talked to anyway had ever heard of a little drug called crystal meth. It just didn't exist to them. Why? Because there was just no need for it, because marijuana was readily available to them.
Okay.
There was no need to go into things like that, very much more dangerous substances.
Gotcha. I want to get to one of our callers because we only have a few minutes to go. George in Texas, please go ahead.
How you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about police going back to that guy with the no-knock warrant. There was this police brutality, shooting dogs and all that stuff. Well, there was a nice little precedent that Scully kept really quiet, but the grand jury ruled in the favor of the parent. The parent had a son that was retarded, and he wasn't a threat to the police officer, and he tased him, and all that stuff. And the father beat up the cop, hogtied him to his gun belt in the trunk, and threw him in the back of his own squad car. But this is what the grand jury said. This is what the grand jury's ruling was. Since you went outside the policy, you no longer have legal protection, and the father had every right to defend his son. Basically saying the police used unreasonable use of force and the father used reasonable use of force.
Wow.
This was a grand jury ruling, and the father had to move out of the city because the police officers weren't too happy about it.
I can imagine not.
But the thing is, my state representative is getting all the documents for me. And it's a little thing, when you hear all about these checkpoints where they're swabbing people and blood draws on the side of the road, here's the little thing I noticed in the little cooperative agreements. And that is when they take these federal grant monies, they're labeled as independent contractors. Not sheriffs, not police officers. That means basically it's an independent contractor. They cannot use that squad car. They cannot use that uniform. They are mercenaries.
The thing is,
as independent contractors, we do not have to comply with their swabs, their checkpoints, or their blood draws because they're acting as independent contractors,
we're really limited on time. I'm going to have to cut you off there because I want Guillermo to respond to that because basically, Guillermo, what happens to people who resist these checkpoints?
It's a good point, man. I mean, the caller raises a good point in that, that may be true. And in the case of internal border patrol checkpoints, it's absolutely true that you are within your rights to not cooperate. The border patrol themselves have even said there is no law that requires you to answer their questions at these checkpoints. However, should you choose to exercise your rights, they will make your life very difficult. They will find a reason, if they particularly dislike you, which has happened repeatedly to people who engage in this sort of activism, they will find a way to arrest you. Because, the threshold is probable cause, but as I've learned in speaking to many different attorneys, is that really isn't that difficult of a threshold to achieve for a police officer. They could say you look nervous, that the dog alerted, that the carotid artery was throbbing. They could say just about anything to say that was probable cause enough to further detain you, to then arrest you, to make it, again, as difficult as they possibly can. They can seize your assets. They can seize your vehicle. They can seize anything in that vehicle. And so, whether or not that's right, I would say it's absolutely not right for that to be going on. That is what happens, and that is what's happening right now along the border and everywhere in America regarding those blood sample checkpoints. It's happening in Pennsylvania. It's happening here in Texas.
Guillermo,
it's everywhere.
We are running out of time. I'll just say that if you want to check out Guillermo's website, it's tracesofreality.com and just Traces of Reality on Twitter as well. He's got great work. I've posted all these links on the facebook.com/thestatelessman site. Otherwise, I want to say, Gimra, thanks for coming on the show, okay?
Yeah, absolutely, man. Pleasure to be on.
Right. So, folks, I appreciate you listening as well. If you want to go to the archive, it is just at thestatelessman.com. I hope you join us next week. Thanks so much.